You're very welcome back to the second hour of this Wednesday's 9 till noon show. Let's go to an email we received in here. Hi, Greg. I've been thinking about contacting you with regard to this for a few days now. This is just to highlight the goodness of people, and especially young people. We are quick to judge people without really getting to know them, including through their ethnicity or their age. I was in Letterkenny on the 29th of September and ended up with a flat battery in my little run-around Peugeot. I was stranded down at the shopping complex across from Deals in the midst of an open bonnet, pouring rain and trying to phone my husband. This young man stopped in the middle of the busy traffic and asked if I needed help. He said, "I'll go and get you a set of jump leads," to which I replied, "Are you sure?" He said, "I'll phone my brother and see if he can meet me halfway." Anyway, he proceeds to phone his brother and then said, "Look, I'll be about half an hour. It depends on traffic." I honestly wasn't sure if he was serious or not, but sat in my car while all other cars went about their day. True to his word, sometime later, this young man returned, parked in the middle of the road and set up the jump leads, and we got the car started. I couldn't believe they'd come back for me and asked his name and where he'd gone. He said his name was Bernard and that he'd gone to Manor for the jump leads. I only had €20, which he gave him, and thanked him for coming back to me. I said, "Bernard, you're an angel. What's your full name?" He said, "Bernard McDonough." A lovely young man and a real gentleman. So if Bernard hears this, or anyone who knows him hears this, I want him to know that I won't forget his good deed. Just wanted to give you a good news story. That's coming in from Margaret. Margaret, thank you for that. More comments here. "Not wearing high-vis or bright clothing is a big problem at the moment. I'm in the Rosses. Everyone walks about these days in dark clothes with their hoods up and probably headphones in. A friend of mine gave out high-vises in the Dunloe area to help with this problem, and still no one's wearing them. People need to be aware of how dangerous the roads in Donegal are. Once it's dusk, you're unable to see walkers." I don't understand how people on the road don't get it, because we're so cautious. We seem to be scared and worried about everything in life now. Do you know what I mean? It's like, oh, everything's going to harm or kill us. This is something that really genuinely could, and we don't seem to take it seriously. Just read that one. "These tombstones wouldn't have been vandalised by children or young people. Young people make a mess with drink or whatever. A caller believes in Donegal we've got an anti-Protestant side. We know exactly what happened in Castlefin. I'm a Protestant and it's so sad to see. People don't want Protestants to have anything or to celebrate being a Protestant. Another, this is a disgrace to happen in any burial ground, never mind religion. I wouldn't make any distinguish at all between whatever the background of whomever it was or who was buried there. It's just an attack on sacred ground and people's loved ones and their headstones. Hi, Greg. How could you bring a world rally to the Northwest and every hotel full with people?" Well, that's not a situation that's going to pertain forever. A caller says, "You need to take vitamin D in Ireland all year round, as we get very little sun, not just up until St. Patrick's Day." Okay, a vitamin D promoter there. Another caller says, "Drugs here are the issue. Someone out of their head, allegedly. Not a person in the right mind would go into a graveyard and do this." Another caller says, "I passed 14 people out walking last night between the road and the footpaths. How many of the 14 would you say were wearing high-vis jackets or any high-vis at all?" And they counted them and they noted it. Oh, I've forgotten now already. Two out of 14 were wearing high-vis. Right, OK. One final remark here before we go to the bingo numbers. The Pope has called for a universal ban on the, in inverted commas, despicable practice of surrogate motherhood, as he included the commercialisation of pregnancy. "As a family, who are a family because my sister volunteered to carry our child after 8 pregnancies for us ended before full term, I'm sick and insulted by his talk. I thought the Pope was different and was making a real change at bringing the Catholic Church into the 20th century. Coincidentally, the same Catholic Church accepted money to baptise my surrogate child." And the same church that sold children as well, effectively, historically. "I'm really sorry for how you must feel with those comments. It is out of the blue." I thought it was out of the blue. I commented on it yesterday when I read the commented on it yesterday, like, why this, why now? I didn't see a massive pushback or objection or issue to it, and there's so many reasons as to why people might do that, but that's what he chose to speak on. And this is one listener who really found it quite offensive. Again, what do you think? 086 60 25000. Now, Senator Francis Black, an independent, along with colleagues, have written to Micheál Martin to ask him to join South Africa in charging Israel with genocide at the International Court of Justice. She believes it's not enough to passively call for a ceasefire. Ireland must take action to prevent the slaughter in Gaza. Senator Francis Black is with us on the programme now. Senator, thank you very much for your time. Good morning to you.
You're very welcome.
I mean, it is... It's actually really hard to comprehend what we're seeing, isn't it? And even the language. I heard Blinken saying that there's too many people dying, too many innocent people dying. Like, what, too many? Is one not too many? It's just so passive, the language, when people are enduring such a horrendous situation.
It's beyond comprehension, Greg. I mean, it's really hard to believe that 4 months on, the war on Palestinian civilians is still ongoing, and we have 23,000 people have been killed, including 10,000 children. Many of them actually are women and children. Many thousands are believed to be lying under the rubble at this very moment. Tens of thousands have been seriously wounded. A majority of the population have lost their homes to this 3 month bombing campaign. And I mean, Israel has now intensively and repeatedly targeted the supposedly safe zones to which it has ordered Palestinian civilians to flee. So it's just, and I actually think, you know, they're nearly conservative figures because of the fact that there are many likely bodies trapped under the rubble. We actually don't know.
Is it fair for me to ask you what you think the motivation of the international community generally is to sort of ignore this, to really effectively give Israel, other than some words, a free pass to do what they're doing? What is the game here?
I think the reality is that, you know, the support from the US that Israel are getting is almost giving them, you know, a free hand to do what they want. I mean, they're trying to, there's no doubt about it, Greg, they're trying to ethnically cleanse Gaza. They want to build like illegal settlements there to satisfy the government's far right religious extremist base. They speak openly about driving Palestinians into the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, and they're trying to negotiate with various African states to receive, you know, Palestinians that they want to drive out. And Israel has always sought to claim the maximum amount of Palestinian land with the fewest number of Palestinians living in it. You know, they've achieved the historically, like, through massive indiscriminate violence, you know, they've achieved this historically through the massive indiscriminate violence. And, you know, in 1948, Zionist militias ethnically cleansed 750,000 people from 522 villages in what's now Israel. So, like, I mean, we know what their agenda is. It's ethnically cleansing, but they're being supported, unfortunately, by America. And look, I just feel that Ireland, like, has to do more. And along with my Shannon colleagues in the civil engagement group, we did send a letter to the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach to asking them to join South Africa's case at the ICJ or to initiate their own proceedings. And as a signatory to the Genocide Convention, Ireland has a positive obligation to do everything in its power to halt a potentially ongoing genocide. We have that ability. You know, Ireland, like, filed an intervention in Ukraine's case against Russia to under the Genocide Convention in the International Court of Justice. And the refusal to do the same when it comes to Palestine, I believe, is cowardly and hypocritical. And that's why myself and the civil engagement group colleagues, my civil engagement group colleagues, sent that letter to the Taoiseach, because, you know, it's absolutely vital that Ireland takes more action. And the Palestinian people look to Ireland because of the, you know, I brought in a bill back in 2018 called the Occupied Territories Bill. And, you know, the Palestinian people were, like, so grateful and appreciative of that bill. And they looked to Ireland for support. So, you know, we need to act decisively and comprehensively to ensure that we live up to our obligations.
Yeah, and also, one shouldn't forget either that much of North Gaza, and it's probably going to end up with the rest of it, has been flattened to the point where no one can return. Far beyond fighting Hamas after their despicable acts early October. The area is being flattened. There is nothing really to return to. Ireland has been has gone a little bit further in its language through the likes of Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin in calling for ceasefires. Some really quite strong language. You don't believe, obviously, that goes far enough. Presumably, you'd welcome the fact that our language seems a little bit more direct and stronger than others.
Well, I suppose just to say that we sent the letter because, you know, it's great that they called for a ceasefire. It's not enough, though, Greg, you know, and the governments, it's like passive calls for a ceasefire. They don't reflect the depth and passion of the Irish people's solidarity with Palestine and their horror at what is being done in Gaza and across Palestine. And the protests and actions all over this country and the hundreds of thousands of emails and phone calls that politicians have been receiving prove that the people in this country want the government to take tangible action to help stop the horrors that's been inflicted on the Palestinian civilians. And the other reason that we sent that letter is because, you know, a case, you know, and we have to really be mindful of this, a case in the International Court of Justice isn't just a symbolic rebuke of Israel. This court can take real significant steps to alleviate suffering at an early stage. And that's really, really important. I really think that's very important. It would take several months for the case to be resolved and for a full judgment to be released. However, the judges at the ICJ can impose preliminary protective measures if they think there's a risk that genocide is ongoing.
It's interesting.
I think that's really important.
It's interesting Leo Varadkar's remarks into this is that he said that he's reluctant to accuse South Africa of genocide unless he's absolutely convinced that genocide has occurred in occupied Palestine. He justified that by saying, "I'd be a little bit uncomfortable about accusing Israel, a Jewish state, of genocide, given the fact that 6 million Jews, over half the population of Jews in Europe, were killed. That certainly was a genocide. A genocide is defined, as you know, as a deliberate attempt to eliminate an entire population or a large part of it." Now, in your letter to Micheál Martin and others, you clearly outlined how you believe and others believe that this actually is a genocide. You cite the meaning and what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, South Africa's legal team have documented many examples of genocidal rhetoric being used in public by Israeli political and military leaders. And, you know, incitement to genocide and conspiracy to commit genocide are separate crimes under Article 3 of the Convention. And the huge civilian death toll in Gaza, the systemic destruction of infrastructure necessary to support human life there, and the efforts Israel is making to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from the Gaza and the West Bank constitute genocide as outlined in Article 2 of the Convention. So there's no credible legal or moral argument for not joining with South Africa at the ICJ. The government, I believe, is making a shameful political calculation out of what I think is out of deference to Washington and Brussels.
So you believe that it's not really about us being sure about what the definition of genocide is you are of the view that the Irish government is towing the Washington / Brussels party line?
Absolutely. I believe they're listening too much, and they need to, and they're talking about not being able to do this unilaterally. I think that's not true. We can do it unilaterally. Now South Africa are doing it. We can do it. We can get behind South Africa's case at the ICJ. And as I said earlier, it means referring Israel to the International Criminal Court, as several other countries have done. So we wouldn't be doing it unilaterally. And again, as I say, we did it Ireland did it when Russia invaded Ukraine.
I think there's
a slight hypocrisy.
Double standards,
there.
I think,
absolutely,
have been accused of.
Double standards, and it's wrong.
Now, listen, I mean, I don't have as much detail as you have. I'm gathering information all the time and formulating opinions and what have you. But the one thing I think we need to be certain of, regardless of current government, opposition, whatever it might be, we really need to be careful here that we find ourselves on the right side of history, because history is being written right now, and it's our children, exactly, and our grandchildren, and we often look back in history and wonder, well, why didn't anyone say anything, or how would that happen? That couldn't really happen in a democracy, or whatever it might be, you know. But we're living through this now, and I think it's vital, as I say, whatever the right thing to do is, I have my sense of what it might be. But it's certainly important that we find ourselves, I think, on the right side of history.
Absolutely.
Because this will be remembered forever, what's happening right now.
And can I just say before we finish up, Greg, that, I mean, we need people power now. And, you know, the government are meant to be, acting on behalf of the people of this country. And the people of this country, we know what the people of this country, they support Palestine, absolutely. So I would call on people who are listening here today to write their local government representative, their local government TDs, senators, Fianna Fáil, Green Party, Fine Gael, please write to them and ask them to support South Africa. And we've only got, like, it's going to be happening tomorrow. We've only got a day, but we need to do that today to keep writing. And then we also have a very large march this coming Saturday in Dublin. And again, we really need the people, because the government, like, we vote in the government. The people vote in the government. They're working on behalf of the people, and they're not listening to the people. And that's what's concerning me at this time. They're not listening to the people. So we have to keep the pressure on. We need people here. We did it back in the 80s with South Africa, Greg. We did it back in, and they eventually had to listen to us. So please, I'm asking the people of Donegal, of all over the country who are listening, to please write to their local government representatives today and ask them to support South Africa's case at the ICJ.
Okay. Listen, thank you for your time this morning. I do appreciate it. That is Independent Senator Frances Black. Thank you. Good morning to you. Okay. What do you think? What do you feel? 086 60 25,000. Acorder says, this time last year, Joe Biden was great friends to Ireland. He's now sending money to Israel for weapons. He's sending tons of weapons to Israel. In Ireland, we couldn't even send over our army. I don't know now if Joe is a friend to Ireland or not. We should be reaching out to Mr. Biden, not the Irish government, that caller says. One of the UK's biggest miscarriages of justice, the wrongful conviction of hundreds of post office workers due to faulty software, has exploded into the public domain following a TV drama sparking demands for justice. In a more than 20-year scandal, some postal workers were sent to prison and others lost their livelihoods and homes. An independent inquiry, as well as a police investigation into the scandal, are ongoing, and top business executives and former ministers are in the firing line. Fiona Elliott joins us on the programme now. She's a former postmistress from Claddy on the border of Castlefin in Donegal and Northern Ireland. Thank you for joining us, Fiona.
Hi, Craig.
Before we sort of get into how you found yourself sort of involved in this, what has the last few weeks been like with people actually finally talking about it, and a drama really being what seems to be the catalyst to get this right back at the top of the agenda again? Is it surreal? Is it about time? Is it frustrating? Are you happy? Are you angry?
I am happy and I'm angry. Mixed emotions. The programme has brought a lot of attention to the public, which is a very powerful programme, and I'm glad that everybody has seen the post office is what it is now and what has happened to all the people and all the suffering they have caused over the years.
So you took over the post office in Claddy in 2005, and this was your sort of forever job. I would suppose you'd have seen it as that, Fiona. When did things start to change for you in the context of this scandal?
Almost straight away after we took it on. We saw a lot of discrepancies coming up in the system. So I kept phoning up the helpline and asking for help, asking for them to come out and give further training. But no help was ever given. Then eventually I rang up and asked them for an audit because I was steady putting money in from the shop till over into the post office till to keep it all right. I asked for the audit. They came out and audit the place and they said that there's thousands missing. They demanded cash immediately. I went and got them the cash and gave it to them. They gave me a wee handwritten receipt for the cash and took the keys to the post office and suspended me for 6 weeks. So I got a solicitor involved then and I went to a meeting in the head post office and they lifted the suspension because I had gone ahead and got a solicitor involved. I think that's the reason why it was lifted so quick and because I had put all the money in that the system showed had lost. So I think I was one of the lucky ones. If I hadn't put that money in, it could have been a different story today.
You should never have had to have done that, though. I mean, I can only imagine, and you've said it in a couple of sentences, but the stress and anxiety over months and years, wondering, well, where was this money going? How was it going missing? Were you miscounting? Was someone else, you know, like it must have been incredibly, incredibly stressful for you.
Oh, very, very stressful. We spent a lot of hours trying to find the missing money. And we were doubting ourselves. We were doubting our staff. It was terrible. No, definitely terrible at the time.
So you paid the 6,000 back. At that point then, did more money appear to go missing or did that sort of ride you over the main focus, the main time frame of this scandal?
No, it still was continuing in the system. You would have rolled over on a Wednesday night and you would have went in on a Thursday and it would have showed a discrepancy again in the morning. So overnight, the phones were going to be messes. We couldn't understand. We thought even it may have been a problem with the internet in the area as well because we're so rural. But turned out to be then that it was the system all along.
And you talked of your relief or being somewhat lucky following that meeting with the four men being told you wouldn't face any criminal offences. It could have gone either way for you. But at that point, any love for the business or attitude towards it was gone, I presume.
That's right. I had lost all heart in it then, so it is. I just thought it was costing us money to keep it open. So we just lost all heart in the business.
And what happened?
The shop end then was struggling.
Yeah, exactly, because it was a full, you know, a business that one relied a little bit on the other, I'm sure. And then what happened? How did that leave you in terms of, you know, presumably you'd invested money or, you know, we know you'd lost the 6,000, but how did this affect your life, your home? You know, you weren't beyond impact.
At the time then, we lost the shop, the post office, and we lost a buy-to-let property alongside that, another buy-to-let property at the time. So we did, and we had them all bought like before that had happened, which is unsustainable then to keep everything going.
I have not yet had an opportunity to watch this programme and I've only read over it over a number of years, but they hardly thought that so many postmasters were individually stealing money. Did they not sort of see a pattern here and saying, well, there's something going on here. We can't have all of these people doing the same thing.
I see. They told us all that we were the only ones.
Wow.
They told everybody we were the only ones. And, like, there's been thousands now that have come forward.
I mean, people have went to jail for this. Marriages were destroyed.
Oh, people went to jail.
They died before the names were cleared.
Yeah. Uh-huh, that's right. It's just terrible altogether. There's so much suffering over the years with it all.
And in terms of the ongoing inquiry, do you follow that? Do you have much interest in that?
Just kind of getting updates weekly on it. So we do have a Zoom meeting every Friday with our solicitors and barristers, and I follow it through that just.
Yeah, okay. And how did you watch the programme Mr Bates versus the Post Office out of interest?
I did. I watched it all in the one night.
And what did you make of it in terms of how it captured, you know, people's experiences?
Oh, it just was so true. These things were just happening. It was just so true. And what people had went through, like we all went through all the suffering, over the years and all the doubting that we had doubted that we were the only ones and this system was definitely nothing wrong with this system, that the money was going missing and we were the ones responsible to put it back in. You know, it just goes to show how many people actually was involved in it, you know, and how good it was for everybody to come as a team and stick as a team. And Alan Bates for, you know, making the programme and things like that, that's good, powerful teamwork between everybody, you know, yeah, to get it this far now.
And again, I just find it remarkable that it took a drama to, for things to change. Obviously, there's huge political pressure now to speed things up, to sort out accommodation. We've seen the former post office boss, Paula Venables, yesterday handing back her CBE. This after more than a million people signed a petition for her to be stripped of it. She handed it back. This all over the Horizon IT scandal. It's like all blown up. It must be a little bit surreal because you've lived this, you know, since 2005, effectively.
That's right. That's right. Well, I think it was the right thing for her to do, to hand back that. But it was long overdue, really. But hopefully everything will be going in the right direction now and we can finally get closure on all this.
Yeah, hugely important that for you and for so many others affected by this. And as I say, there are people who have passed their names not cleared, people who've spent time in prison, and then the impact it has on their lives outside of that, marriage breaks up and what have you, and mounting debt. And then obviously, you know, wanting your name cleared, to be officially told you did nothing wrong and to be compensated for that. Well, we hope that happens sooner rather than later. Fiona Elliott, thank you very much for your time this morning.
No, Beller, thank you, Craig.
All right, take care. Bye-bye, Fiona. That's Fiona Elliott, who's a former postmistress from Claddy on the border of Castlefin, between Donegal and Northern Ireland, of course. That Horizon IT scandal, very soon after she took over that post office, money started going missing. It didn't go missing, but the Horizon IT system suggested it did. But what was really interesting, it was happening to so many people, and no one in the post office, or certainly no one soon enough, said, well, it can't be all these people individually that are stealing money. There has to be a problem with the system. But they were telling people individually that they were the only ones. It's crazy stuff. Definitely going to get to watch that show, hopefully now, between now and the weekend. A caller says, I empathise with your Protestant texter and I share a sense of outrage and sadness for the wanton and shameful destruction, but would try to suspend any snap judgment as this truly is a global phenomenon. I would infer that damaged and disturbed individuals are responsible regardless of denomination. And I didn't want to in any way try and blunt that earlier texter's listener, but unfortunately, and the trend, I don't think these people discriminate between one or other. We have seen Catholic churches, Protestant churches, the damage done to the graveyards, of course, but churches entered, money stolen, donation boxes opened, damage done to altars. You know, I don't really think that these people that are responsible for this really do distinguish between one religion or another. I'd be very surprised if they did. But what we've seen is that many churches have been, from all denominations, have been targeted. A caller says, whoever said that about Protestants doesn't know what they're talking about, think they want to stir up something that's never been here. It's how they feel, though. And I'm not the thought police. If that's how they feel, I want to give them a platform to say so, but hopefully we get a balance on that whole issue in the round. Fine people who do not wear high vis, then they'll start wearing it, is one listener's suggestion. It comes in from time to time, no doubt about that. They need to bring in on-the-spot fines for people walking without high vis. It's very selfish and dangerous what they're doing. Poor drivers always blamed. Another, hi Greg, I'm in shock at a person walking at a dangerous bend in the dark at Ballymacool yesterday evening, completely head-to-toe in black clothes. And not only that, walking on the roadside with no footpath and cars having to go around them. And the sad thing about it is there's no footpath on the opposite side of the road serving walkers. If you are a walker, I just want to get an insight into it. There's bound to be some of you out there listening that that walk in dark clothing. Can you give us an insight into it? And it's not, you can do it anonymously, by the way, texting the show. It's not to try and single anyone out, but what's going through the head? Is it that the cars can see me? Is it that I'm not really on the road. Like, what is the mindset of someone who is prepared to walk on a dark road in dark clothing with cars, lorries, tractors, all heading in their direction or behind them? Let us know. As I say, it's only to get an insight. It's not in any way to try and sort of, you know, attribute blame or anything like that there. Okay, we are going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be reacting to a comment that we received yesterday from a business owner regarding the employment of under-18s, and it sparked quite a bit of feedback, and we're going to talk about that on air after these. Now, we received this comment from a listener, and it reads as follows. I'm a business owner who employs people of all ages. I think that young people should do the first few months for free before I invest in them. I wonder if other employers agree with this. I personally will no longer be employing young people of this age. Many need a mentor for about a year. From January, I have to pay 15 and 16-year-olds €8.90 an hour. Many of them are not worth €5 an hour. It takes months to train them, and at times training can be unsuccessful. I might as well pay the extra and hire the 18-year-old who I know has a better work ethic. This is an attitude many business owners I know are now developing, and it will have a huge impact on young people. What are your opinions on this? Now, this is a genuine, by the way, this is a genuine email received from a business owner. We're not in the business of making stuff up here. So we were able to verify that business owner. That is their view. Let's talk to some guests on this now. Susan, a previous youth worker. What's your views on this business person's comments, Susan? Good morning to you.
Morning, Greg. When I read the comments last night, I thought they were completely absurd. First of all, I think that anonymous comments don't really deserve the time of day. You know, people can say these kind of contentious things under the cloak of anonymity, but if they were to actually put their name to something like this, I think they might have a lot different attitude. But speaking from my own experience as someone who started working in a bar at the age of 16 and working with young people, I can safely say that some of the young people I've worked with have been the most hardworking, respectful people I have worked with. And I suppose when you read a comment like that, you have to kind of read between the lines of why this comment was made in the first place. And it looks like perhaps this employer isn't given the support and respect to the young people that are in their employment, and that is probably where the issue lies. You know, young people need to be supported and respected just like everybody else, offer training, include them, and obviously as well, it comes to the correct recruitment procedures, which obviously have not been followed here. Otherwise, you would have been able to fit the young people to the position required.
Yeah, and whilst publicly the comment is anonymous, if this is a view amongst at least some business owners, I think it's worthwhile to have the conversation out in public, because what could be happening, you could have 15 and 16-year-olds going to this business, you know, fingers crossed this could be them getting a summer job or what have you, and they don't have a chance because this person's already made up their mind that they'd prefer to invest in the 18-year-old. It's unfortunate. It's a shame and a waste of time for the younger applicants.
Well, I think it's actually probably good for the younger applicants that they won't be getting employed by people that have this kind of attitude anyway. I think it's much better for them to get employed by someone who is supportive, who is respectful. And if they don't get employed by an employer like the person who made these comments, then I think that's probably better for everybody involved.
All right, Susan. Listen, thank you very much for that. That's Susan away there now. Bernie's owner of Stitch It Bernie. You're like me. You started working at 14, Bernie. I never stopped. I left school and started working at 14. That's my background anyway. But anyway, to your point more generally, Bernie.
Yeah, I agree with the girl just before me. But I think there is more than just 15 and 16-year-olds with bad attitude. There's adults that is in these jobs that doesn't want to be there, but they're there and they're getting paid. So, like, I have young kids. Well, not young, but they're that age. And one of them got work placement through his college, at his college in Oma. And he worked 3 days, but he got £20. And I had to drive him nearly 30 miles for them 3 mornings and the evenings. And he worked from 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock. And he got about £20 for them 3 days. Like, it wasn't even a tenner a day. I think that's disgraceful, the way they do treat young people. It's not very fair. We're all young. I started when I was 14. I did babysitting before that, and I got paid. You know, everywhere you went, you got paid, and that was it. There should be a start wage, which whenever I was, and then every 6 months when you get on, it goes up.
Is there any room in your mind, Barney, for, say, for instance, five for an hour if there is training provided? I mean, do you think there's any sort of middle ground there?
I don't think so. I don't think a five for an hour. Why would they get out of their bed for five for an hour? Because you got to think, they're not driving these kids at 15 and 16 years of age. They have to get transported to this work, wherever the work is, or somebody has to take them. So they're out that money before they even go to the job. Mm. So why would they work for a five for an hour?
And
I worked, 35 years ago, and it was more than a five for an hour then.
Exactly, and we were all young once. I mean, it's the way the system works,
isn't it? Yeah, and we
all
need to start.
Mm.
Yeah, and what's to stop that person from employing 15, 16-year-olds, keep them on for a couple of months, drop them, bring on a couple of more, keep them on a couple of months, and keep doing that so he has free labour all the time. I don't think that's very fair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Pamela joins us as well. Hiya, Pamela.
Hi there. Hi.
I'm all right. Your view is a little bit more sympathetic, I think, to that business owner.
Well, I suppose it is, yeah, because I see both sides of that argument. Okay, first of all, I have to applaud him for making such a controversial comment, because there was a lot of backlash there, and I think people reacted with their heart, but haven't thought about it. I think it's important to sort of highlight that, you know, he's thinking about money. I think money would probably be his main motivation, and he's not seeing training a young person as an investment. He's not thinking about that young person long term, and he's placing all the blame and responsibility at the teenager's feet, and that he's saying that basically they should be coming to him with skills that he requires them to have if he's going to take them on unemployment. But they're just out of school. There's a reason why they left school in the first instance, at the age of 15 or 16. He, as a responsible employer then, should be thinking about them as an investment. He should see them that they are a diamond in the rough. It's his responsibility to select the right candidate. It's his responsibility to shine up that diamond in the rough and turn it into a diamond, where he's highlighting, I guess, that he's not a responsible employer.
But you, Pamela, are of the view there are two parties in this, though, and that he should see the benefits and the potential in the young person, but that the young person should see the benefit in the mentorship and the development, and therefore do you believe there should be an element of free labour or reduced cost labour if that's the nature of the relationship?
No, I don't believe that at all. No. If that employer is expecting a person to join him for 3 months and work for him for 3 months without paying him free labour, what he's done is just devalue that young person. He's told that young person that he's not going to be valued as an employee, that he doesn't have the worth to have the status of employee. I think really what's required there is that employer has a mindset change, that he changes his attitudes, and I'm just saying he, because obviously
it's generic, I get you.
He needs to change his attitudes and his perceptions and realise that this is an investment. It is long term. That young person, you know, once they are polished up, could be excellent at the job, but to pay them nothing is basically devaluing them at the outset. Therefore, if the young person doesn't feel valued, why should they give value then back to that employer? You know, even in the long term, if the argument is that the employer said, oh, but I train them up and then they leave their skills, they go off to Australia, they go off to Europe, you're making an investment. You are taking a risk as an employer. But that young person could go up to Australia, get up skills, get additional skills and learn more and come back and then find that because the employer was so good to them, they ask them for a job again when they come back.
I think this person has a deep root view of young people because they say, I might as well pay the extra and hire an 18-year-old who I know will have a better work ethic. I mean, I don't think you can make a sweeping statement like that. I've seen 14, 15, 16-year-olds run off their feet and 25-year-olds with their elbow against the wall. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not having a go at 25-year-olds either. I just don't feel
you can
make that sweeping statement.
Yeah. I mean, what evidence is it to suggest that an 18-year-old will be better than a 16-year-old? Okay, even though they get a different pay, you know, minimum wage, 8.89 versus 10.16. But on the whole of it, it's down to the individual person, isn't it? It's down to that young person. and the commitment and the motivation that they have. And I would assume that if a person is leaving school at 15, 16, and they're going into the workplace, they're really motivated to work because things may be, school maybe may not be for them. Academically, they might have struggled, or they just have talents, gifts and skills in work-related skills. They have work-related skills that are good.
Okay, Pamela, listen, thanks for your time. Are you still there, Bernie?
I am indeed, yes.
Is there, though, a possibility that maybe, and we as parents and caregivers and guardians have to take some responsibility here, that our younger people are a little bit more entitled now and they're like, well, I'm not doing that for that. You know, when you were 14 or when I was 14 or 15, if someone told me to jump, I'd say how high. And if they says I'm giving you €60 a week or £60 a week, I says, all right, that'll do. I'll have to give 40 of that to my mother. I don't want to old man it, like, but you know, it's a very different generation now. Perhaps maybe he's seeing more of that, or she's seeing more of that.
I don't actually think that person has children at all. When we started work, like, we all worked in a factory, and I stayed in that place for 11 years. If they hadn't trained me, I wouldn't have my own business. You know, I still wouldn't be doing what I was trained at. But we worked, yes. And you did overtime and all the rest. You did long days. You handed money in home. But I can't see that, how would you put it? Younger people aren't, they haven't got the same attitude as us, no. But that's our fault. We kind of mollycoddle them, 100%. But if they want, like, most of them are saving for cares.
Yeah.
Or most of them are saving to go on holidays with their friends. And they have to get themselves a wee job to do that.
Yeah.
But they know they have to work. But you do see older ones in these jobs that doesn't want to work. They don't even want to be there. There is a place in Letterkenny that every time I go into that shop, it's all young people that's in that shop, and they're the most nicest young ones.
Yeah, that's my
they pass you, even if they pass you a few times, each and every one of them said hello or good morning or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
There's not very many older ones that does that.
Bernie, thanks for your comments. Really appreciate you coming on. I do appreciate that. Fiacra O'Flaherty's from O'Flaherty's Bar and joins us now. Fiacra, good morning to you.
How you doing, Bob?
I am doing good. Have you noticed over the years, before we get to your wider point, a change in younger people's attitude? Because you would have seen 14-year-olds from a few years ago, well, not 14, say 16, 17-year-olds from a few years ago versus now. Is there something in it that they're maybe not quite as switched on or motivated in the workspace as previous generations?
Well, no, all my experience is good, hey. No joke. All the experience I have from the 16-year-olds, 15, 16 and 17-year-olds have all been great, you know. But it came with a bit of work.
And you think that, you know, the importance of part-time work should be emphasised to younger ones, even in school, and it would be a lift for the hospitality trade. Tell me briefly about that.
Like, I personally think that hoteliers, restaurateurs and publicans should actually be going to schools and teaching the importance of having a part-time job, either in the summertime, wintertime, holidays, because school's not all about homework, to be honest with you. You need to learn a big part of growing up too, and a big part of growing up is having a job. And in the hospitality industry, at 15, it's kind of hard to get on a building site. So in Ireland, hospitality is the number one go-to for work experience.
I think it's also very good for character development. A lot of interaction with other people, your work colleagues, the public. I think people grow an awful lot through that too. You will have seen people come in the door, shy and retiring, and a few months later, Fiacra, that, you know, they're full of confidence and the chest is out and the shoulders are back.
Yeah, that's like, I've had kids coming in here for, like, with their mothers handing me in their CV for work experience, like, and they didn't open their mouth. And a year later, I could hand them kids the keys and I could go away on holiday for 2 days and them kids could run the place. And then only 16.
Brilliant stuff. Fiacra, thank you so much for your time. Fiacra O'Flaherty there is one of the owners of O'Flaherty's Bar.